Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 40 years ago, a get-tough-on-crime spree rolled out in state legislatures and general assemblies across the country, leading to the largest prison industrial complex in history. The system is expensive and, many believe, ineffective, far from rehabilitative and more focused on pure punishment. Joining us now to talk about that is Todd Clear. He's co-author of The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. He is dean of the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University and the founding editor of the journal Criminology and Public Policy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I remember the Get Tough on Crime surge in the Ohio General Assembly back in the early to mid-90s. You say the story starts, actually, though, back in the 1960s when crime became one of the most pressing issues of the day.
That's right. And this was both a public issue and a political issue. And the politics of the day arising out of the urban riots in the 60s and civil rights demonstration and Vietnam War demonstrations and public disorder, at the same time that crime rates were growing rapidly at an annual rate, this sort of public reaction emerged that everything was out of control. We had to get this whole thing back under control. And the phrase law and order, which was, you know, a single word, developed as a way of characterizing a point of view, which was that society had lost its moorings and the bad guys were winning, and we had to get this thing back under control.
Now, of course, when we look back at the 60s, it seems outside of the civil unrest and the urban riots, didn't seem that out of order. It seemed pretty controlled. What sorts of laws were passed back then that put us on this trajectory?
Okay, so there were really decades of laws.
And yes.
You can identify them in a series of changes. So for most of the 70s, the laws that were passed had a minor effect on prison populations for most of the growth. The last year that the prison population dropped was 1971.
Okay.
So it's really been 40-some years. Now it has dropped. This is the point the book makes. It's dropped the last three consecutive years. So for the first time in 40 years, we now have declining prison populations. But for every year since 1972, prison populations rose. And for the first decade or so, the growth was mostly due to increases in crime rates, which is understandable. You got more people committing crimes, you make more arrests, more people go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
But there were beginning to be tectonic shifts in underlying structures that produce prison populations, and those were just starting in the 70s, and they began with a series of sentencing guidelines reforms that tried to reduce judicial discretion at the sentencing stage that were very common in the mid-70s. In the 80s, we started seeing statutes that limited the availability of probation as a sentence, mandatory sentencing statutes, and they ran the range of crimes, but they started really with drug crimes. So the argument in the 80s was people who commit drug crimes are fueling our streets with crack violence, and we have to do something about it. And the way to do that is to send people who are involved in drug crimes to prison. And then in the 90s, going into the early 2000s, but in the 90s, most of the these are all generalizations, but most of the reform was around recidivism statutes. So we saw three strike statutes and two strike statutes saying that if a person's convicted of a felony a second time or a third time, the penalty they receive should be enhanced. So one way of looking at this is that the prison population is produced by two numbers, how many people go to prison and how long they stay. And for a decade, we increased the rate of going to prison given a felony conviction. And then for another decade, we increased how long you go to prison given that you're going to prison. And between the two, we produced a sustained prison population growth for almost 40 years that had nothing to do with crime rates, really. And so that, for example, in the early 1970s, the probability of going to prison given a felony conviction was about one-fourth. By the year 2000, it was three-fourths. In the early 1970s, the median length of stay for those who were in prison was hard to estimate, but estimates suggest it was about 15 months. It's now about 30 months. And the really long sentences are the ones that have been that have really grown. So, and so we have 160,000 people in the United States now serving life without parole sentences, and we won't know how long they stayed in prison until they die of old age. We won't even be able to, demographers can estimate what the median length of stay is, but we really won't know what it is until those people die in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And so we had a policy framework that grew out of a sort of a politically fueled fear of crime agenda mm-hmm. that that produced sustained prison population growth across the United States for almost 40 years, almost four decades.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Todd Clear right now. He's the dean of the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University and the co-author of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. If you have a question or comment for Professor Clear, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd like to hear from people who have been sentenced to prison, who feel like they've been part of this change in incarceration trends over the years. 614-292-8513. Todd, you brought up judicial discretion. That has been not eliminated, but faded over the last 40 years. What was it about judicial discretion that legislators wanted to take away?
Well, the ability to put a person on probation.
Yes, but why?
Legislators thought that judges were being lenient on criminals, and that that was that was not teaching them a lesson. It was partly an incapacitation argument. You know, if you get these people off the streets, their crimes are prevented. But it really was mostly a deterrence argument in those days, which is people think they can get away with whatever. They're going to commit crimes, go to court, and come back at, right back out on the streets, and we want to teach them a lesson.
As far as that recidivism trend that occurred during the 1990s, was there any evidence, any research to show that grounding somebody for the rest of their life or for longer the next time they did something wrong would make a difference?
There's almost no empirical evidence that it would make a difference, and there's growing empirical evidence that it does not. And these are very difficult dynamics to study.
Yes,
because you can't really produce a randomized, you know, the way scientists learn the effect of an intervention is to do a randomized trial, which means you do it randomly with some people and not with others, and then you see what the difference mm-hmm. is. And of course, we haven't done that. So, but the current state of the evidence on this, I think, is pretty clear that longer sentences don't produce more deterrence than shorter sentences. And if you compare people who look similar, some of whom get probation and some of whom go to prison, and then do their rearrest rates following 3 years and 5 years out, you find that the people who go to prison have a slightly higher rearrest rate on the average. And so if there is an argument, the argument would be that the prison sentence is the one that produces the greater likelihood of committing a new offense.
You call it the punishment imperative, and you describe it as a social experiment. Now, given what you were just talking about, the lack of empirical evidence, how is it an experiment? How could it be tested anyway?
Yeah, well, you know, so what scientists do now is to compare one period of time to another period of time, or compare. So there's enough variation across the states in what the states have done. Mm-hmm. Some states have much higher incarceration rates than others. So, for example, the lowest states are in the hundreds. The highest states are in the 500s and 600s. So you can compare across states. You can also compare across jurisdictions within a state, and you can compare different time periods when different policies were in place. They're not perfect comparisons, but they provide social scientists with a framework for trying to understand differences. And if those differences are consistent across multiple comparisons, of course, then you have more confidence that that what you're arguing occurred is actually what occurred.
And when you talk about hundreds versus 500s and 600s, you're talking about per 100,000.
Incarceration rate. And let me also say that A lot of things go into produce. So what I said, the number of people who go to prison and how long they stay, that's how you get a prison population.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different things go into those two numbers. How many crimes, how many people are arrested, what the sentencing policies are, and a lot of things go into that. What the number of people living in poverty, the unemployment rate. And so it's hard. The thing about a true experiment is you control for all those variables by randomly assigning the treatment. Well, you didn't randomly assign prison policy. So all those other factors are doing their work, and you have to find out a way statistically to control them out, and that's not always easy.
When you go with it as a justice system, it has to apply all equally to all equally, or at least intend to do so. Are all justice systems like the one in the United States in comparable countries in I guess the free and rich world? Do they operate the same way so that the outcome is much the same or not? Because the United States is much different than other countries. Does it start with the justice system? Is it the sentencing system? Is it the prison system? Where does it differ?
I think we don't have a great answer to that question that we can really hang our hats on. The best I think we can say is that culturally some countries simply have an embedded social attitude that does not engage in punitiveness as a value in the way that the American culture does. We have historical strong belief in the value of being punitive, the social value of being punitive.
Where does that come from? Because we all come from, the nation comes from, we're a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, so some people argue different things. I'm kind of taken by an argument that some social scientists have made that it is this deeply held belief in individualism that is at the core. So if individuals are the mechanism for, achieving the American dream, you come to America, you're free to do whatever you want to do, then individuals are the ones who must be held responsible for conduct, both successful and unsuccessful. And so we don't put much, as a country, we are very quick to hold individuals accountable for their misbehaviors. And so I understand that idea, but that by itself doesn't explain why we would be way more punitive as a society than many other Western societies. Not all. I mean, we look like Russia. We look a little bit like South Africa. We look like some of the developing world countries that make heavy use of incarceration. So it's not like we're completely unique, but among Western democracies, we are unique.
My guest is Todd Clear. He is a co-author of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. We'll return to our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For every 100,000 people in the U.S., 220 of them were jailed in 1980. 20 years later, that number had more than tripled to 731, the largest number of any country in the world by far. And it's expensive. The money states spend on prisons has increased at 6 times the rate of spending on higher education. Still with us to talk about that is Todd Clear. He's co-author of a new book on the topic of the American prison system, The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. Are there regions in the country more into imprisonment and punishment than others?
South and West.
Okay. Why?
Well, if you think this, sort of buy the cultural argument that I made about individualism,
mm-hmm.
It's a stereotype, but there's some truth to it, that those beliefs are more strongly and deeply and widely held in those regions of the country, South and West.
And you said that the momentum was building for the system that we have now, even as the forces driving the policy shifts diminished. How so?
So What has happened in the last few months, or the last couple of years in the United States, is that a combination of three factors has led to broad questioning about the wisdom of having a very large incarcerated population. One of them is fiscal. You know, we've gone through a very tough fiscal time. States are hard pressed for money, and they've seen the prison system as a big growth area where they have not been able to contain the growth. And fiscal pressures have produced this idea that maybe we don't need these large prisons, especially since crime has been dropping for a decade nationally. Crime rates today are what they were in the early 70s when this prison boom started. The second pressure is that we now have increasing information that the collateral consequences of incarceration have been really problematic. So crime is concentrated in poor communities and in among people of color. It has been intergenerational. People go to prison, find it much, much harder to succeed than they did before because of the punitive laws that have been imposed on them when they're released from prison, and all these collateral and increasing research, some of it my own, of collateral consequences for people who don't even go to prison. If you live in a neighborhood where you have a lot of people cycling in and out of the prison system, you feel those consequences even if you yourself have never been to prison. And then the third is that suddenly we have an explosion of other people demanding, priorities demanding our fiscal and programmatic attention, schools, healthcare, retirement, and so on. So when you put these together, the fiscal crisis, empirical evidence, and other priorities, for example, on public opinion polls, it has been 20 years since public safety has been in the top 10 on public opinion polls. So what you get is a sea change in this 40-year-long, and we call it in quotation, experiment in incarceration.
It's been said before, of course, the system that stands is inherently racist, according to many who have studied the system. Where did that come from? Why did it? Is it because of that? Apply it to everybody without regard to their background, without regard to anything particular about them as an individual?
Well, there's pretty good evidence, pretty good visual evidence that race was played a central role in all of this. So, the Get Tough movement was got its biggest push forward by the Richard Nixon campaigns, and in which the advertisements about law and order showed black people rioting in the streets. Mm-hmm. Got another huge boost in the first George Bush presidential campaign with Willie Horton. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting when you go back. I had a graduate student do some research on the Willie Horton ads. Visually on the nightly news, when the Willie Horton issue was talked about, of course Willie Horton was black. Mm-hmm. When a face was put on the screen when it was talking about a person who was committing a crime, 90% of the time the face was black. When a face was put on the screen of who was a victim of crime, more than half the time the victim was white. And so this was producing this visual idea that crime was black people attacking white people. Michelle Alexander talks about it very well.
Of course, from OSU, right. OSU scholar. So, but this phenomenon, this isn't just the Willie Horton ad from the first George Bush campaign ads. This is the media.
Well, this is the media, and it's also the way the social production of criminal justice occurs. So. You don't need to have a racially producing instrument to get a racially unfair consequence. So in neighborhoods in Brooklyn that are predominantly African American, the rate of people going in and out of prison per adult male age 20 to 40 is between 7 is 7 per 1000, 8 per 1000, 7 per 10,000, 8 per 10,000, 9 per 10,000 in those neighborhoods. In the white neighborhoods that are predominantly white, the rate is 10 times less. So what you have is this result that is racially disproportionate that itself becomes a problem of racism, whether or not there are racism instruments producing it. So Bruce Western, a sociologist at Harvard, has written a wonderful book, an award-winning book, Punishment and Inequality, in which he shows statistically that the growth in the number of black males going to prison has been an instrument of increasing social inequality between whites and blacks in America. Just look at it this way. So if the neighborhoods that produce the largest rates of cycling in and out of prison are impoverished neighborhoods, and the in concentration in urban areas, many of them are deeply African American. If you go to prison, your lifetime earnings is reduced by 40%. So if you live in a neighborhood that has a lot of people cycling in and out of prison, you live in a neighborhood where a lot of the men, maybe most of the men, have lifetime earnings reduced by 40%. Mm-hmm. So this is a neighborhood that cannot support business. It cannot support good restaurants. It cannot support stores. And the kids who grow up in these neighborhoods don't have access to the kind of money to get them stuff that kids need when they're growing up. So you produce impoverishment by concentrating these effects in this neighborhood. And whether or not you ever go to prison, you live in a neighborhood that experiences those results. And if you live in one of those neighborhoods, you're black. So through a series of connections, you produce in the chapter in my earlier book on this, mm-hmm. I call it Death by a Thousand Little Cuts, mm-hmm. You produce this truly racist result, whether you have anybody making racist intent decisions anywhere along the way or not.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Todd Clear, co-author of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. Bob in Columbus, you're on the air with Todd Clear. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Oh, yes. Hello. There has been a real deliberate effort to lock in certain cities to lock up people in prison who have done no crime. I'm talking about especially black males. I've never been to prison, but I've been falsely accused of something that, you know, could have got me sent to prison. My two worst encounters with policemen were both when I was coming out of the library with books in my hand. Now, right there, what does that tell you? Aren't there other places where they can go to find real crimes going on? But that's my concern. They're deliberately trying to lock up black men who have done no crimes.
What is the sense, Todd Clear, that the part of the issue begins at the law enforcement level?
Oh, there's no – you don't get to prison without getting arrested. So mm-hmm. there's at least a 100% correspondence in that regard. One of the problems was the drug war. It's not the only problem here, and you have to be careful because it's really very much not the only problem here, but it's a big part of it. So there's what economists talk about as an inelastic supply of potential drug offenders to give get involved in the criminal justice system through drug enforcement. So you can go into any city, any urban area in the country, go into the poorest neighborhoods, and drive around and make drug arrests as many as you want. And because so many of those neighborhoods, except in areas where there are heavy Latino populations, so many of those neighborhoods are African American, it creates this idea that the drug problem is a black problem. But it turns out high school juniors and seniors who report their own drug use in the prior year, whites are actually much more likely to report much higher rates of drug use in the previous year than blacks. So it is a law enforcement strategy. Some people think deliberate, but it doesn't have to be deliberate, mm-hmm. right? It has this effect anyway. But it also produces this idea that the problem of drugs is a problem of African Americans, when in fact what we know is that white rates of drug use parallel those across the country and may even be higher.
Thank you, Bob, for that call. What about what Bob said about how many people have been, falsely accused and served time in prison? The Columbus Dispatch has done an entire series on that, and it's an ongoing series of people who are, well, there's the Innocence Project out there. people who are being released because there's new evidence coming forward. It seems almost like a plague sometimes.
So thank you. That's an interesting point. I want to say I've been on panels a couple of times with people who served decades or longer in prison for crimes they didn't commit. It's a pretty emotionally affecting thing
yes.
to know that. And there's plenty of injustice. But the work that the Innocence people do is just extraordinary, and I'm a big fan of that work. But that is not the source of mass incarceration.
Okay.
There are lots of people in prison who didn't do what they're accused of. But if every single innocent person was released tomorrow, we would have a problem with mass incarceration in the United States. It's produced by policies that are not the policies that the Innocence Project goes after.
Okay.
I want to shape it another way.
Okay.
So when I like to ask audiences when I talk to them to remember their college days and remember their high school days and think about their patterns of illegality in those time periods. It is almost always the case that everybody in that audience, if they're really honest with themselves, will admit to having committed crimes, drug use crimes, crimes of inappropriate sexual activity, and so on, in their youth. Most of the people in the audience never got caught for them. So I draw two things from that. One is that this idea that and then as a consequence, they've had, because they never got caught, they never had to deal with the consequences, and they've lived out, they grew out of their criminal activity years, and they're now no longer criminally active. So the first point I make is that that we have to understand that criminal activity is very broadly distributed among the population. Almost every study that's ever been done where people report their own criminal activity, whether caught or not, finds in the 80-90% of the people have committed a felony in their teens and 20s. So it's most people break the law, and that's just the truth. Most people break the law. Most don't get caught. But the other thing is that the second point I try to make is this moral idea, look, if you break the law, you deserve to be punished, is actually hypocritical, because we don't really believe that. We believe if you break the law and get caught, you should be punished. But if you get away with it, like we did, then you shouldn't be punished. Only people with the moral standing to actually punish others, ironically, are those who themselves have been caught and punished for their crimes. In other words, the only people who can morally make the claim that everybody who has committed a crime should be punished are those who've gone to prison, done their time, and are back out.
To what extent, speaking of, you mentioned, you referred earlier to adult males 20 to 24, and any psychologist will tell you an adult male 20 to 24 is anything but an adult. And I know you understand the distinction there, but to what extent has the juvenile justice system been part of the problem or part of the solution, or could it be?
Well, we don't know much about how to do the kinds of things. Young people get involved in breaking the law. Need interventions. We don't know much about the interventions that are really going to make the differences. And what we know, we don't practice very well. But that said, the juvenile justice system is a really interesting example for America, because at the same time that prison populations for adults have been growing for almost 40 years, as I said, in the last decade, prison populations for youth have been dropping dramatically. And we don't see there were these predictions in the 80s of these hordes of depraved youth who were going to be attacking us because they were without really there were editorials written by people predicting mayhem by young people unattached to social values. And we've actually been incarcerating young people less, arresting them less, putting them on probation for shorter terms, and across the country, the amount of criminal conduct reported and attributable to young people has been declining.
David in Columbus, you're on the air with Todd Clear. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi. I think this is a good topic. It doesn't receive much airplay, but it seems like I've heard that a lot of aberrant behavior is not just inherent in the individual. It's caused by a lot of environmental factors, such as heavy metals, toxics like lead and mercury. And that, when that's reduced, then the aberrant behavior goes away and possible criminal behavior goes away.
So there is good evidence that those sorts of biological factors play a role. Some people believe, some criminologists believe the role is fairly significant. I'm not sure that it's that significant.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's going on is that worldwide there is a decline in criminal behavior. So the almost two-decade-long drop in crime rates we've experienced in the United States parallels the one in England. It parallels crime rate patterns in other European countries. So there are significant sort of social, foundational social thing factors that underlie rates of crime, and causing them to go up or down is very, very difficult. So I suspect that we get a benefit by limiting lead in paint, by increasing, by reducing child abuse of infants, mm-hmm. by increasing nutrition, and there is very good evidence that healthcare and social support for children in the years 0 through 5 and 0 through 7 have long-term and very significant sustained impacts on later rates of criminality. So there are things we can do that are in the package of interventions you described. We don't do them very much, but they would have collectively a pretty significant impact.
Okay, I'm talking with Todd Clear. He is the dean of the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University and the co-author of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today on 89.7. It's 41 degrees, sunshine with a high near 50 today, clouds tonight with a low of 39 and a chance of rain. Rain is expected for Friday and Saturday, but the highs will be in the 50s.
Join host Eric French and his guests for a look and listen back to the best local music acts of 2013. Bring your own appraisals. That's coming up Friday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Todd Clear. He's the dean of the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University and the co-author of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. We have an email from Steve. He writes, I have worked with the criminal justice system in Ohio for several decades, and I have seen much of what Dr. Clear describes. I think we are in much better shape now for dealing with these issues for two reasons, data and analysis. The first reason is data and analysis. In the 1970s through the early 90s, there was no data to describe what was really going on. It is the increasing availability of information and a concern for evidence-based decision-making that is helping to convince people that other remedies besides prison can be used. Number two, more evidence that there are programs which can help. This in place of the defeatism of the 1970s and 80s, believing that all the police can do is catch and lock up.
I agree 100% with those sentiments, and they're well said. It gives me a chance also to recognize some exceptional work done by colleagues and friends of mine at University of Cincinnati and their College of Criminal Justice. They have been working closely with the criminal justice system in the state of Ohio and in urban areas in Ohio on evidence-based practice. And what we now are learning is that there are that we chip away at this. You know, we identify a program that works, and then we try to implement it effectively. And then we identify something else that works, and we implement it effectively. And you work point by point on implementing stuff you have demonstrated to be effective, and stopping doing the things that you know are ineffective. And over time, the system takes the turn. And it is the case that one of the reasons why prison populations in the United States are dropping now for the third year in a row is that there has been a response by the criminal justice system to anchor its programs in a stronger evidence base.
You devote the final chapter of your book to a plan to dismantle the system. And before we get into that, because of course I really want to talk to you about that, can you tell me if there's anything, has anything like this been dismantled before? Is there any sort of template for such an endeavor, or was it the fall of civilizations that brought about these kinds of changes? Because it's so massive.
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult to bring down, and because there are currently lots of interests in maintaining high rates of incarceration. On the other hand, it is not sustainable. It produces the exact problems it's trying to deal with, and so as a result, it can't be maintained over. It has to itself begin to draw down.
Mm-hmm.
But we invented this punishment imperative. We're going to have to invent the antidote, and I think it's going to take a lot of different strategies operating in a lot of different areas.
A lot of political will, too, because it's still easy to call somebody weak on crime.
Yeah,
or soft
but here's
on
the
crime.
Interesting thing. I agree with that, but I haven't seen an election in many years where the weak on the top, soft on crime issue mm-hmm. was even close to important. Now, so mayors get elected in cities like Philadelphia, where crime still is a very serious problem, and they get elected on other platforms. It was not an issue in the recent mayor election in New York. It hasn't been an issue in presidential elections. And ironically, the states that are doing the most innovation right now in trying to reduce prison populations are red states, Texas, Oklahoma. And in the state of California, where the most dramatic thing has been done, it was produced by the court system. And the politics of it seem to be working out. So it's very. So I think I don't want to overstate this, because let's face it, if crime rates start traveling up at a rapid rate, I think this whole conversation changes. But as long as crime rates remain stable or dropping, the political side of this, there's a lot more pressure on health care, on retirement, on infrastructure. The conversation that politicians have to bring to the people in order to get elected cannot be this Johnny One Note, get tough on crime anymore.
John in Akron, you're on the air. It says here that you were incarcerated.
In the 80s, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Was it for a felony?
Felonious assault.
So you were in prison for how long?
I was in prison for almost 10 years.
What did you do?
What did I do?
When you were in prison, right.
To get there or while I was in there?
No, while you were in there.
I was fortunate. I went to prison in the 80s, and I took advantage of the college programs. I didn't even have a high school diploma when I went in. I got a high school diploma. I got almost 100 credit hours. There's study after study. That's why I called in mm-hmm. to talk about. I've read studies since back in the 80s of how, from a master's degree, that the recidivism rate goes down to less than 2%, and it gradually climbs, reduces with an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, et cetera. I also get up and home, and I work. I pay my taxes. I own my own home today. I have a family. I get the other side of it, too, as a law-abiding, tax-paying person. I don't want to pay for people to get a free ride, but it's penny-wise and pound-foolish here. We're going to complain that we're spending $20,000 or $30,000 to give a felon a free education, but instead we'll spend $100,000 to keep him locked up for 3 or 4 years. I'd rather make him a productive member of society, and isn't that the Christian way? And I'm not meaning to down. I believe in God, and I'm not going to get into the Christian. But I don't understand, and I don't understand that the prison system is the only government entity that society accepts a 90% failure rate.
Hmm.
If our bridge collapsed at 90%, society would be in an uproar. There's a solution to the problem. And, I mean, there's a solution to not even letting it get there.
Well,
our educational system, if it works right in inner cities as it does in Hudson or other areas, maybe all these people wouldn't end up in prison.
Todd Clear, what do you mean? And John, thank you so much for giving us a call. We appreciate your point of view. Todd Clear?
That's a very interesting point. And most studies show that programs in prison don't have much effect on recidivism, but education is an exception. The RAND Institute recently produced a report that showed that attending college classes while incarcerated reduces recidivism rates by 60%. There is no other program in the history of program evaluations of correctional programs that has had that level of impact. So if we were to offer in all the prisons in the United States college courses for those students, those people who are incarcerated who are eligible to take courses and want to take them, we would immediately have a powerful impact on return to prison rates, and the program would save money.
John in Akron, thank you so much for that call. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier, though, about the average time of incarceration is double. It's about 30 months now, right? How much can you really achieve in 30 months? It's sort of a no man's land when you're there for just such a short period of time.
Yeah, 30 months seems like a short period of time, but let me just say that if anybody who's listening to this call asks what they were doing, in 2009, in the month of what would be 6 months, in the month of June of 2009, and then thought of all the things that have transpired in his or her life between June of 2009 and today, all those things not having happened, I think people will recognize that a lot of life happens in 30 months. There are some studies that show that drug treatment programs need to be at least 30 months long in order to be effective. But the length of stay, increasing length of stay so you can do more, doesn't seem to be an option that has much promise.
Okay, so let's get to your plan. First of all, repeal mandatory sentencing, especially for drugs.
Right, because in the early 1980s, before the drug laws really started coming into effect, 3% of the prison population was in for a drug crime, and 10 to 15% of the people going into prison were going in for a drug crime. And people going in on drug crimes were getting very short sentences. By the time these changes were in effect, as much as half of the people going into prison were going into prison for drug crimes, and one-fourth of the people in prison on any given day were there for drug crimes. So we just changed the mix of people in prison through these drug penalties. If we reverted back to the earlier policies, we would get the earlier set of prison populations.
And when you're saying drug crimes, ostensibly we're talking about nonviolent drug crimes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there are. I mean, by themselves, crimes that involve possession or sale of drugs are not violent.
Okay. Why doesn't mandatory sentencing work as a deterrent like it was thought it would?
I think there are several reasons why, but most people who go to prison don't think they're going to get caught, and most people who go to prison think if they get caught, they're not going to get sentenced. And people have the experience to back that up. Most of the time, when you commit a crime, you don't get caught.
Mm-hmm.
So the mandatory penalty doesn't change the odds of going to prison, given a crime, that much. Most of the literature on deterrence finds that the likelihood of getting a penalty is much, given that you commit the act, is much more important than the size of the penalty, and small penalties that are very likely, given that you commit the crime, have much more deterrent impact. So what this has led people to do is been to work with folks who are on probation or parole and try to impose very short penalties for return to drug use or failure to abide by the rules, because you have a good quality of surveillance of those people, and you can know very quickly if they're breaking the rules. But for regular folks in the broad society who aren't, you know, giving drug tests all the time or being watched by a parole officer, that the level of surveillance isn't there to make sure that if you commit a crime, you're going to get caught, and if you get caught, you're going to go to prison. Hmm. And even though that language sounds like it makes a lot of sense, you just can't implement it.
You also believe that the laws should change to reduce the length of stay.
If we went back to the prison, in the sentencing policies of 1980, within a very small number of years, we would have the prison population of 1980.
It's just that simple. I mean, repeal the laws of the 90s, or many of them, and
just that simple.
Mm-hmm. You refer to special early release. What do you mean by that?
So there's some places that have gotten where their prison systems have gotten. This is not as much true right now because prison populations are stabilizing. But some places had a lot of pressure on their prison populations, and they had to reduce their prison populations, and they did special early release. They picked a bunch of people who were within 6 months of release and released them early, right? And the reason this is a self-defeating policy is that it doesn't change anything of the underlying structure that's producing the prison population. Again, prison populations are produced by policies that put a lot of people in prison and make them stay there a long time. If you let a bunch of people out early, let 1,000 people out early, 6 months early, within 6 months you'll be back to the exact same prison population you had because you're not affecting the flow in and out, right? You're just simply taking a bunch of people and taking them out of the picture for an average of 6 months. So, but what you do with those is every crime that's committed by anybody who's released, quote, early, close quote, is due to the release policy, and so you make these release policies vulnerable, even though the original release policy that you're replacing also had people released who committed crimes. Somehow you end up making the early release policy responsible for all the new crimes.
When you're released, what difference does it make if you aren't educated, you can't even vote, you can't get a job because there's so many places that have policies against job, you can't afford to go to school. Maybe you can get health care now, but for a long time you couldn't. It just seems like everything is stacked up against people who have committed felonies, been convicted of them, and imprisoned for them.
This is, I think, one of the central points of the punishment imperative, and I want to recognize, as I say this, the how great it was to work with my co-author Natasha Frost, who's an associate dean at Northeastern University in Boston, on this. In fact, the phrase "punishment imperative" was hers. There was a period of time in which it was imperative that anything you thought about with regard to criminal justice reform had to be punitive. And if you had people on the streets, you had to treat them more punitively. And we stacked up again and again all these things because we believed in this idea that if we made committing crime so miserable, people won't commit crimes anymore. And we made it so that people who were leaving prison had limited incentives to obey the law and a ton of incentives to break the law.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. All right. Yeah, I mean, they changed the law for a long time. People were being trained in prison to cut hair, and then a law passed that said you couldn't get a license to cut hair if you were a felon.
Because you would have scissors in your hand, and that was
right. Right, exactly. So this goes to the reduced recidivism element then. Well, I just want to say, Todd Clear, we could talk about this for a lot longer. Obviously, it took 40 years to get us where we are. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today.
Thank you. I think we're on the cusp of a brand new era in the area of correctional policy, and I'm going to enjoy seeing it emerge as it happens.
Well, thank you. Todd Clear, he's the dean of the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University. He's also the co-author, as he said, with Natasha Frost, of a new book. It's called The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff for all of their hard work this year. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, and special thanks to all of our interns this year. Some of them aren't with us anymore. Kiram Shaban, Emmanuel Joshi, Shannon Clary, Annalise Dahl, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, Jocelyn Smallwood, Olivia Rojas, and Leticia Wiggins. Thanks for all of your help. We could not do it without you. With video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Saturday.